You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast. We're here to discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode, The Child. I'm Data Logan from Bremerton, Washington.
I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. And tonight we do have a guest on for our maiden voyage of Season 2 for Next Generation. We're talking about Data Logan. Okay, Data. And as I've already told you off air, the Data part is really throwing me off. And you said something that I found very interesting about that, that it makes perfect sense, but for some reason it's driving me crazy. Why don't you tell them what you mentioned about the Data part?
Well, I picked up the name Data like 20-some years ago in high school. It was a nickname. And I really have adapted it and taken it on as my name, even legally changed my name to Data, or at least my middle name. But I do find I go around my life now. I don't even think about it myself. Just introducing myself as Data, talking to people as Data. And most people don't bat an eye. But I have found that Star Trek fans, you know, people that know Star Trek really well, actually tend to be more put off by the name than regular people. I think because they already know Data. They already have this impression of who Data is, and I don't necessarily fit that impression.
That could be. I mean, I suppose if you had been born Data, it'd probably be easy to take, but the fact that you actually changed your name to Data, and obviously it was because of the android, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was because of that. In high school, I went to one of these high schools where I didn't know anybody, right? I was new to town, new to the area. I was a big Star Trek fan already. I wore t-shirts with, you know, Data's face on it from the television show.
Wow.
And people initially started, they didn't really know who I was, and they just said, oh, that Data guy over there. And I really glommed onto that and, you know, took that as a nickname.
Wow.
And then eventually, like I said, I changed my name legally to Data. But I think names should be or can be a really fluid thing, you know? When I was really young, I was Jimmy. And then I grew up a little bit and said, no, I don't want to be Jimmy anymore. I want to be James. You know, that was the name I was born with. And then I took on Data, you know? And maybe later in life, I'll change my name again.
Jean-Luc.
Why do names have to be so static?
Yeah, I know, but I don't know. Okay, well, I tell you one thing. This is a moment where I really sincerely wish Brian Baker was aboard and was able to talk to you, because his persona was always the android. So, I mean, I would love to have heard him say something like, well, that's not even something he even thought of doing. But we'll never know. So.
Well, I could always tell people I'm not named after Data from Star Trek. I'm named after Data from Goonies or something else.
Okay. All right. Well, then, why don't you tell us, do you do a podcast at all? I mean, I know you've guests on a few. But
no, I haven't taken that step into the 21st century. I'm still I'm at the level where I do data logs sometimes. You may have heard them on different podcasts, mm-hmm. where I'll just do like a couple-minute clip that I call a data log, uh-huh. and I'll send it out to other podcasts so that other people get to pay to put me on the internet, and I don't have to do that.
Yeah, tell me about it. Okay, well then, Data, if you're ready, let's just head on into the synopsis.
Okay, the synopsis for tonight's show is: Counselor Troi is shocked to find out she is pregnant. Wesley Crusher is weighing his options for the future with the help of the proprietor of the ship's lounge, Tin Ford. This is the season premiere.
Yeah.
This is the first episode of season 2 of Star Trek The Next Generation. Original release date, November 21st, 1988. This episode was written by Jaron Summers, John Poville, and Maurice Hurley, and directed by Rob Bowman. Guest stars include Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan, R.J. Williams as Ian, Cole Meany as Transporter Chief, still with no name, Don Arneman as Miss Gladstone, Zachary Benjamin as the young Ian, and Dor Keller as Crewman.
Crewman.
Hey, we don't have a name for... Oh, man, what's his name? The scientist.
That's a good point, and also the baby.
Well, I don't care about this baby, whatever. I haven't watched this episode in the last week. I was Hester Dell.
Hester, that's a very good point. Let me.
Plus, technically, Diana Muldaur as Pulaski is a special guest star. She's not a.
I must have forgot regular. To put the special guest stars down. So let's see here. No, they don't have them. Oh, a guest star, Seymour Castle as Hester Delt.
Okay.
I missed that one. Sorry. And special appearance by Diana Muldaur as Dr. Catherine Pulaski. I wonder if she's going to be special appearances for this whole season.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, really? She was never added to the regular crew rotation or the intro.
All right, then.
So what do we think about this episode? I really like this episode, even verging on love.
This.
What about you?
This should be interesting. It's nasty, terrible. It's not nasty, not terrible. I don't know what it is. It's hard to put your finger on, but yeah, there's some good parts and bad parts. What about you, Doc?
It's not nasty or terrible. It's neither of those things. Actually, I watched this earlier on today. It's better than I thought it was, because I do think it gets a bit of a bad, has a bit of a bad reputation this episode. But I actually thought it was fine, and I thought there were some nice things in it. To be honest, there are some things I don't like, but I think the overall it kind of is quite nice. To be honest, so I don't know which side I'm gonna be. Be coming down on.
Yeah.
We'll see. We will see.
I haven't figured it out either yet, but that's why I said nasty and whatever, but no, it's not really that bad. So before we go into the episode, why don't we discuss some of the changes that have occurred between season 1 and season 2? Maybe we can talk a few seconds about each. They include
you kind of do this sweep at the beginning of the episode, and you almost pick out a lot of them. At that in a big sweep.
Yes.
And and I do have a list of them.
Oh.
Yeah, the direction there was really nice, the way that the episode starts in it.
Yes.
Just the first 30 seconds of the episode is just full of new stuff.
Right. So, well, I'll just mention what I have, and we could talk about what I missed. I'm sure there's a couple things. But first, we have Dr. Beverly Crusher has been promoted to head of Starfleet Medical. It is expected that she will flourish in her new job, curing diseases like the Tellurian or the Tellarian or the Terralian or whatever plagues possible. Wesley Crusher is slated to join Mommy soon, and when the current mission is completed, or so that's the promise. But in just like all good stories, misdirection is key. So we do have a new doctor. What's your guys' first impression of the first time we meet Dr. Pulaski?
Well, the first time... I'm sort of surprised we're jumping to that so far, but the first time we meet her is when, Picard realizes that she hasn't checked in with him yet. He says, where is she? She's in 10-4. He goes to 10-4, and he's about to chew her out for not coming to see him and for just lounging in 10-4. But really, she has been doing her job immediately. She's been dealing with a medical problem.
Right.
And she just looks up and says, oh, Captain, I'm going to blow off your whole rant that you're about to go on. Why don't you sit down? You need to hear this. Let's talk. So, I mean, from the very get-go, she stands out to me as this character who's not gonna put up with Picard's gruff. I mean, she's gonna be business. She's gonna get the job done, and she cares about people. She generally cares about Deanna and what she's going through. So I like the intro of Pulaski.
And so, Data, are you a fan of Pulaski coming into the second season?
Yeah, for the most part. Obviously, we'll talk more about her relationship with Data and you know the little problems there. But generally, Pulaski seems like a very competent doctor. We're given the impression that she's way better than Beverly Crusher, you know, medically speaking, because other doctors know her and look up to her and talk about papers she's written. Beverly papers too, but it seems like Pulaski is much more well-respected in the community. And she's more willing to stand up to Picard. We see a little bit of that in this episode, even that intro, like I mentioned, but you see it more in later episodes. Whereas Beverly, I think, maybe because she had her own personal issues with Picard, things that she was dealing with, she was less willing to stand up to him. I mean, you remember the first season, there was like, three times that Picard got taken over by an alien entity, and she timidly says, well, maybe we should not have you in charge. And he says, no, I want to be in charge. And she's like, okay. You know, Pulaski would never put up with that.
Right. Yeah, that I think the same thing. When she first starts talking to Picard, there's so much promise there that she's going to stand up to him, and she ain't going to take no bull. But then when she starts nitpicking on Data, I thought this is where she starts going wrong. And because we all love Data. Everybody loves Data. And to treat him the way she does, it just kind of is a turnoff. So. Okay, but we could talk more about that later. How about Lieutenant Geordi LaForge has been promoted to the drop-in chief engineer, although interestingly enough, he'll remain dropped there for the duration of the series. Oh, spoiler alert. So, you guys happy with Geordi being promoted?
Yeah, I thought that was a very good choice, you know, to take a series regular and put him in the nap. It's weird to me in hindsight that they didn't even do that from the beginning, really. I mean, the idea going into the Next Gen, as I understand it, was Gene Roddenberry had the idea that technology was so well developed that it wasn't going to be a problem. It wasn't going to be the thing that drove our episodes. And so we didn't need an engineer to be a main character because we would be doing other stuff. We're much more interested in what's happening on the bridge, which in hindsight, how could he have thought that? I mean, Gene Roddenberry has made a number of mistakes, and I think that was one of them. And it just worked out. It was fortuitous that they were able to take Geordi and repurpose the character a little bit and put him in engineering, where he really fits.
Okay.
Now, actually, I absolutely agree. And, I mean, Geordi really, really fits in engineering. I mean, the way that he's written from this point onward, it's had you not seen season one, it really takes a while for you to recognize that he's actually not the chief engineer during the first season. So I'm a very big fan of him having been moved. And something that they do in order to get around the issue of you know, having one character down in engineering all the time, you know, they do have the engineering stations on the bridge. And I think, you know, that there are instances even in this episode and the next where, you know, Geordi will be on the bridge and he will be doing his engineering stuff. So I think that it's absolutely a good move.
Okay.
I think both Geordi and Worf at this stage look better in gold, I think.
Oh yeah, I think the uniform color was an improvement on both of them.
Yes.
And of course Worf also got a new sash, which looked much better than that like paper thing that he was wearing in the first season. And of course he got a new forehead and haircut, but we sort of ignore that and say, no, absolutely, his forehead always looked like that. And you know, the forehead had been stolen, and they had to make a new one. I think that was the impetus. Like, the original mold that they were making his foreheads out of.
Really?
Was part of the issue. I read or heard that somewhere.
Well, you know, some people get cosmetic surgery. He decided to have his ridges look more formidable. Okay.
I like how, and this is getting ahead a little bit, but in the third season when his parents come aboard, they're like, oh, you put on some weight. It looks good on you. you know, just acknowledging the fact that, yep, he looks pretty different.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, well, another thing we have is the captain's private prostitution room has been converted into a social hall. And the name of the room has been changed from the 4 to 10 inches to 10 forward. Did I say that?
Sorry, I didn't know where you were going. I'm really sorry. Just to be clear, I don't get any of this scribbling.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, what happened to his ready room? I didn't notice any changes to his ready room.
His prostitution room. Okay, well, this change, this change continues a long, proud tradition of taking a room designated for the captain's private whatever and changing it without his permission. I doubt that happened here. But anyway, we have a new bartender in 10 forward, is what they call it, named Guinan, who wears some of the strangest hats. So let's talk about Guinan in 10 forward. How about Guinan? What do you like about Guinan?
Oh, Guinan is great, right? Let's just start on 10 forward first. I think that okay. Something we brought up when we were listening, when we were rewatching season one, is that there wasn't a place where the characters can interact, like off duty. And I think that 10 forward introduces that place.
Right.
So I think it's a good place where you can set a lot of conversations that surround the character development and whatnot. And I think in particular, having Guinan there, who's kind of a relatively unknown character. She's a bit like elevated above everyone else in terms of, you know, who she knows. She's not interacting with them on a one-to-one basis, but on a slightly higher level. You're at least you're given the impression. I really like her. I like her character. I like that she's supposed to have a relationship with Picard, and by that I mean she knows of Picard, and they've been together or they've been through stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it's great
That's a little misleading in the episode.
Right.
If you remember.
Right. And I think what you're talking about is she said, no, I never knew the captain before it came on board. But obviously she couldn't have said, well, yeah, we met on a planet, or in the 18th century or wherever that was. That would have been giving out information that they shouldn't have had at that moment.
It would have been more interesting if she said, I didn't know the captain until he came on board. Which would have been more accurate because he was the captain before they first met, because he was time traveling at the time. We're given the impression in this episode that 10 forward has always been part of the ship. Guinan has always been on board. It's not like she just came aboard. I mean, she was there throughout the entire first season. We just never saw her.
Right.
But she does lie. I mean,
yeah, she has to.
I think it's pretty clear, not that Guinan and Picard interacted not only, you know, in that time travel episode in her past, but I think there's a relationship that Picard had with her in his past, like on the Stargazer or sometime. That like they have known each other before 2364 mm-hmm. or whatever, when he took command of the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's 10 forward. How about the bridge? The bridge has a slightly different look. Once where there were plain walls on the sides of the bridge, we now have massive computer databases installed with blinking lights.
Oh, is that new?
Yes, it is.
I hadn't noticed. I mean, I looked at the bridge and I thought, there's something different, and I had it down as, I think the carpet's different.
That might be, but yeah.
I think they changed the captain's chair as well. It didn't have the...
Yes.
Those two
right.
panels that flipped up on the side, they changed it to the up sweep sides.
No,
like that.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's kind of like slightly more compact now as well.
Okay.
Compared to how it was. Certainly unencountered Farpoint with the, you know, when they were looking over the big fold out section. No, that's true. And yeah, I think it's, it looks good.
I wonder, you know, how you explain those little differences in universe. Like, Geordi got promoted to chief engineer, and he's like, hey, now that I'm chief engineer, I have a little ideas about little ways to change the bridge. What do you think, Captain? Let's do it, you know?
Right.
Just think about those kind of things.
I mean, actually, perhaps it's a sign of my, over fondness of Star Trek, but I always look at whatever changes there's been and try to explain them within the universe and say, well, is it reasonable that they could have put, you know, an extra station here or an extra station there or had changed this, that, and the other? I don't think there's anything that can't be explained, right? I don't think there's anything that's so completely far-fetched. I'm a bit confused as to why Worf didn't get a gold uniform when he became Chief of Security at the end of Season 1. Because there are a couple of episodes where I thought that he, you know, after having taken over from Tasha, he would have gone gold straight away. I think of those kind of things.
Yeah, I think the idea there was that it was a temporary, like it hadn't really been permanized or it just took a while for the paperwork to go through. Because he's not promoted, right? He's still a JG like he was in the first season. He just changed MOSs or whatever they might call it in Starfleet. Of course, there were two novels written that take place in between the two seasons that sort of show the change more gradually and stuff that was happening at the time. And then, of course, we haven't talked about, like, the biggest change from the first to second season, of course, Riker's beard.
That was my next one. And mustache. Yeah. The full Riker. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm not sure what it's called, but sources close to Starfleet Medical claim like LaForge's visor brings him powers no ordinary man could muster. The beard is said to thrust him into the spotlight of stories as well as the bedrooms of more than 73% of the ship's female crew, including those of every color. And, of course, that 73% of the crew that consider themselves female. This didn't take into account for future species that might consider themselves something like, oh, gender neutral or something. But obviously that was the beard of power.
I'm sorry, you're cracking me up. Yeah.
I wondered where Lou gets this stuff.
Oh. So, Lou, we've been on hiatus for about 4 weeks. It looks like you've been busy.
Oh, I've been busy.
You went straight back to work the following day.
I must have. Yeah, 73% of it, the crews. Anyway. Well, that's pretty much all I have of the changes.
And 80% of statistics are made up?
Yeah. Pretty much, at least. That's all I have for changes. But what do you guys have?
I've got a couple more. We kind of mentioned it, although off air. O'Brien is quasi back. Mm-hmm. So he's back and he's in the transporter room. And I think he pretty much stays in a transporter room until he leaves at, well, mid-season 5, is it? Mm-hmm. Whenever. Early season 6, when the S9 gets started. He's still doesn't have a name, but he is in his kind of, you know, the role that he's going to become familiar with. And also, because Geordi steps out of Helm, someone steps in, of course, and that's Wesley. And Wesley's in his grey pajamas.
Right. And he only steps in to the Helm when it's not time to kill somebody, so we can talk about that another day.
And I think the design and the forward stations were changed. They're less relaxed, less, you know, laying down. They're more sitting up. And the shuttle bay is new. This is the first time we saw shuttle bay 2.
That's right.
And the shuttlecraft that's leaving in like the 3 seconds into the episode, that's new.
Yeah, I had that down as well, with a question mark at the end, because I wasn't 100% certain. But this is the first shuttle bay that we see, question mark.
And I think, maybe I'm misremembering, but inside the captain's ready room, is the Stargazer model new? I don't think that was there in the first season.
No, it's not there originally, because he has an Enterprise there originally, I think. It's a Constitution class originally. He then gets the Stargazer. I think that you're right that it happens at this point. I think it's clearly after the battle and so on. But I don't think he gets it in season 1. I think he gets it in season 2. So that's a good spot.
I wonder if that Constitution class starship model that was in his ready room was originally meant to be the Stargazer. You know, because, you know, they changed it. In the script, it was supposed to be a Constitution-class starship, but then they changed it. They even filmed it using the word Constitution, but then they dubbed over it and made it Constellation, made it a different design. But it was originally supposed to be that Picard had previously served on a refit Constitution-class starship.
So. Oh, wow. I mean, that would make the... obviously, that would be a very old design, right? That's been in use for a very long time. I mean, it almost rivals the... I always find it strange that you... It's to do with when, obviously, these things were filmed, right? You obviously had Star Trek III filmed, and you obviously had the props made for the Excelsior, and it's obviously clearly a good design ship, a good prop, and as a result, all of the kind of, you know, that the Type B ships that turn up with various admirals and stuff are always Excelsior class. And at the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, whoever designed that ship originally in Star Trek III, you know, within the universe, it's still going good, you know, 90 years down the line or whenever.
Yeah, even in this episode, we see one. The Repulse is
absolutely
Excelsior class. So yeah, that design of ship does tend to go for a long time. But they did make the decision. No, the Constitution, that's too old. But even the Stargazer class is, you know, the Constellation class is supposed to be a pretty old type ship by the time, you know, by the time the Stargazer was lost nine or 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So. And it looks it looks clunky. It looks old. It's not sleek.
Oh. Okay. Can I ask something that might sound stupid? You said something earlier when you were talking about Worf. You said JG, and as I'm watching and looking at Memory Alpha, it actually says that Geordi LaForge and Lieutenant JG Worf. What the heck is a JG?
Junior grade.
Oh.
So not full lieutenant. Well, junior grade lieutenant, or you know. I suppose either senior or full lieutenant. So he's got one gold pip and one black pip.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, because I remember he says he wants all his junior officers to learn. And I never heard the reference of JG that I know of, junior grade. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's just traditional Navy rank.
Okay.
Nomenclature there.
Okay, any other changes before we go on to the story?
Well, I do think the sick bay is new. If you remember in the first season, the sick bay set didn't actually exist. What they would do is they would take the conference room set and redress it as the sick bay set. And then in this episode, it's clearly not the same set. You know, it used to be in the first season, whenever you went into the sick bay, all the sick bay, the beds in the sick bay, you know, like right behind them would be this. What is obviously the slope of the conference room and the windows that would exist in the conference room, except it had been, you know, painted over. It was all white whenever they were using it as a sick bay set. But now in this season, you know, sick bay is different and it doesn't have that sloping curve to it because it shouldn't. Sick bay is not on the edge of the ship. It's at the center of the ship. And I think it's deck 10, right? Or sick bay on deck 6. Whatever, but it's an interior. It doesn't have an exterior wall on the exterior of the ship because that would be stupid. But then again, putting bridges on the exterior is also questionable. But
I never noticed that. I never noticed that. But when you mention it, I think that you're. I mean, I can actually see it. And I think you're. Of course, you're right. The one problem that I've always had with the sick bays. I mean, there's supposed to be over 1,000 people on the ship. There aren't enough beds in sick bay, and then there are never enough beds in sick bay. I assume they must have another set of beds, or they can extend sick bay, but the stuff usually on display is a top 6 beds or so.
I think they do make that clear in a couple episodes. Like they refer to it as, sometimes they refer to it as the main sick bay is where the CMO's office is, and that's, you know, in the center of the saucer section, but they certainly have some sick bays down in the star drive section, and maybe some other ones. But then again, 1,000 people, generally you don't need that much bed space. I mean, I did serve in the U.S. Navy for 6 years, and, you know, I mean, I've been on ships with 15 or 5,000 people, you know, regularly, 10,000 sometimes when you were carrying a lot of people. And you don't have a lot of beds. You generally, you know, even in a group of 1,000, not that many people get sick at once. And if you do have an epidemic, well, then you're probably putting people up in their quarters anyway. It's not like you need to bring them in sick bay. So I don't think it's that crazy. In fact, throughout most of the series, it seems like maybe Dr. Crusher or Dr. Pulaski are one of only a few even medical officers on board, which is, again, not that unrealistic for a ship of 1,000 that they might only have one or two doctors. We know in the original series, there was probably only two doctors on board, you know, McCoy and Mbinga, and that ship had about 500 people, and now you double it. I think there was an episode in the third season, Remember Me, where Crusher states specifically how many doctors she had working for her. And it's not that many, you know, like three or four doctors in total on the entire ship. So I don't think that's too unrealistic.
Okay. Sounds good to me. Okay, now how about the story? we good here?
We're good.
I gotta warn you, though. I mean, I got like 4 pages of notes on this story. So much to talk about.
Okay, good. Well, then we're on our way to Odit 9 to pick up some medical samples to transport to Rochelis, where an outbreak of unspecified plasma plague threatens to wipe out the people. But while we're en route there, the Enterprise is boarded by a ball of light that turns out to be a player. And he likes the girlies. He's a player. The only problem with this guy is he practices unprotected scanning, which ends up making Counselor Troy pregnant. You like that? Unprotected scanning?
Lou, you have that. and I've got light bulb goes around Enterprise, ends up in Troy's bed.
Yes. Getting Riker all upset.
Teaser ends.
Teaser ends. I noticed the way the ball light seemed to slither up Deanna's legs. Anyway, you can see the light under the blanket all the way up until a certain point, and that's where Deanna seems to be writhing in. I'm not sure if it's happy writhing as well, but do you think she might have been dreaming of Will again? Or something like that?
Wow.
I choose not to speculate. Okay.
But either way, she wakes up huffing and puffing, so it must not have been Will. What do you guys think of the intro ball of light?
You know, there's that brief little scene where two people are walking down the corridor and the ball of light's behind them, and then they seem to sense something behind them, and they turn around just at the moment when the lights disappeared up on the top. And then they look at each other and go, huh. I'm like, obviously these are just like side, what's that word, background actors or whatever, but I didn't think the acting was very good there. It's like, that's an exaggerated, huh.
I can't believe they didn't see it, because they turned around as that thing was swinging up into the ceiling. I find it hard they didn't see something. They didn't even look up, like, well, did I just see that? And, above all else, they didn't report it. So.
Well, I think the impression we were supposed to get was that they didn't actually see anything. But it's hard to say.
The ship is haunted. Okay. Well, so now she's pregnant.
But Data had already picked up something.
Yes.
Right? Data had picked something up on the sensors and reported it to Riker, and Riker says, huh, well, if it's something happens again, let me know. We'll just ignore it.
Yeah.
For now.
Do a scan. Do you see any emissions? Yes, I see one in Counselor Troy's quarters. There she goes again. Okay. So, Picard tells Data to consult Dr. Pulaski, sir, about what's coming aboard. Where is the good doctor anyway? And like you said earlier, she's in 10 forward getting plastered. No, she's not. So he's going to handle this, and not a good way to meet your captain. But there we get the story of Deanna's pregnancy. So it happened overnight, and she's going to give birth within 36 hours. Here's something I was thinking about. This whole pregnancy thing. I think that this, I think I alluded to this in an email I sent you guys, but I think this might have served better on Voyager, because then we could have maybe explained Naomi Wildman's wild growth of, you know, she was, Samantha was pregnant for over a year, And then, when she finally gave birth, 2 years later, the child is 12 years old. I mean, I think this story, modified a little bit, might have been better on Voyager. What do you guys think?
You mean, like, as a long-term story arc
right.
on that show?
Right, it's still...
That's an interesting idea.
Why Naomi grew up so fast. But they didn't do that, so...
Yeah, it's the... Oh, I'm sorry. Were you...
Oh, no, sorry. But you always... I mean, there's always a problem, right? Whenever you have children, in particular, whenever you have babies on the TV show, literally the first 18 months of a baby's life is baby sitting, lying down, not doing anything. And then the next 4 years is really, you know, people having great difficulty in doing anything well and screaming a lot. So generally that doesn't translate very well into television, which is why whenever you have people born, and, you know, Naomi Wyman was one of them, and also Alexander was the other, and Molly, you know, you have to get them to a certain age very, very quickly, because otherwise people are going to want to kill these, you know, baby actors on the television, because they really aren't going to be doing anything interesting for the first, you know, 5 years or so.
I really think that with the O'Briens, they did not accelerate the time. I think they did well with Molly and Kiryoshi.
I think Molly got up to like 3 quickly, and then I think the same actress was kept for the entirety of Deep Space Nine. But you certainly got over the first hump in terms of the age, in terms of getting her to be able to walk, getting her to school, that kind of thing. And then from that point onwards, I think you are right, it was fine.
Yeah, you're probably right. I think because Molly was born in the 5th season, right, in Disaster.
Yep.
And then in the first season of DS9, like in If Wishes Were Horses, which supposedly is only a year and a half later, she's up walking and talking, so there probably was a little gap there. It's easier, obviously, with Worf, or, you know, with Alexander or with Naomi, because they're aliens, so you can just say, hey, it's alien. It's still... You know, is a little incredible that any being could develop too fast. And that really gets into this episode when the child, like, overnight becomes a 4-year-old. You're like, where's the conservation of mass there? I mean, was that kid just, like, constantly latched onto Deanna's breast all night in order to get enough nutrients to build that much? I mean, Deanna would have died. There's obviously some magic going on.
He went to bed with a pizza and a tub of ice cream, and then woke up, you know, a stone heavier, fully formed.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, so on the way to 10-4 to give the doctor a few tongue lashings, he runs into his son Wesley. A lot of people don't know that. But if you ever heard the thing Brian Baker did on Wesley Picard, it was actually pretty funny. He analyzed the entire thing to come up with why Wesley could be Picard's son. So, I don't know if I can dig that up. I'll put that in the show notes. Okay, so they chit-chat a while about how hard it's going to be to leave the Enterprise. Now, I don't know if you guys picked this up or not, because I never did all these years. But Picard says, mixed feelings for all of us. Now, what do you think that could mean? If I were Wesley, I'd sure like a little explanation. To have mixed feelings, some would have had to be sad, some would have to be happy. So, who's who?
Well, I think that's pretty clear that's what they were meaning there. That Picard was ambivalent about the whole thing, you know. A part of him really wants Wesley to be gone out of his life because he feels uncomfortable with children. And possibly because he feels uncomfortable with his child, as you say. But at the same time, he really does care and like the family, you know, maybe.
I mean, actually, I was going to be a little bit less generous. I was going to say that Picard really doesn't want Wesley around, and he's trying to be positive, and the best he can come up with it whilst being polite is mixed feelings. Because, I mean, I took this entirely that... You know, Wesley sitting there, and he's saying, look, it's going to be really hard to leave the Enterprise. And he's saying, yes, mixed feelings. He really has very little empathy for Wesley in this scene. You know, maybe he wants him around a little, but No, I took this as Picard really being the I don't want to use the word child hater, but the guy that wasn't comfortable around children from season one.
So let's talk before we go on too much further into the briefing room, but just the fact that Deanna is pregnant, right? This is a rare thing in Star Trek, you know, for certainly a primary character to get pregnant, but even for background characters to get pregnant. And Star Trek, you know, I mean, it's a progressive show, especially with race relations and stuff like that, but there's definitely some topics that Star Trek avoided. And premarital sex, or, you know, sex outside of marriage is one of those things. It seems like almost every single time you hear about pregnancy in the Star Trek universe, it's between a married couple, right? I mean, O'Brien and Keiko got married before they had Molly. And obviously Paris and Torres got married before Sisko and Cassidy were married before they accidentally got pregnant, right? So they're always careful about not giving the illusion that there's some premarital sex going on. Well, most of the time. And then you have other episodes like Justice that implies, well, maybe there is a lot of premarital sex going on, but at least they're probably using protection. But Star Trek doesn't want to talk about that. It doesn't want to talk about condoms and that kind of stuff. So it avoids the topic whenever possible, you know. And there was an original series episode. I don't know if you remember Who Mourns for Adonai, where Carolyn Palmer, or whatever her name was in that episode, that, you know, she was a Starfleet officer, and the original script called for her to get pregnant by Apollo. But they cut that. They were not allowed by the studio to film that scene because it implied that she was having sex with this guy who she wasn't married to. You know, obviously that's 60s television, but even later in Star Trek, it doesn't happen very often that there's this implication of premarital sex. I mean, you get some much later with Trip and T'Pol in season 3 of Enterprise. They definitely had premarital sex.
Okay. Well, beyond all that, what I'm getting at is, I mean, when they talk about what to do with the child who's growing inside of Deanna at an alarming rate, Worf jumps up and says, obviously, it needs to be aborted, to which there's now a debate. I mean, I kind of thought, I don't think Star Trek really completely stays out of current events like that. Because obviously I thought today's moral story was about abortion. Either way you may fall on whatever the issue is, at least they brought it up. And that's what she steps in and says, no, you do what you got to do, but I am having this baby.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to talk about pregnancy in general before we got into the abortion thing, because that is a whole other thing. And this is one of only two times I know of when abortion is ever mentioned in Trek. And I don't think it is the focus of this episode, although I do think it is one of the most important things that happens in this episode. I think the writers were trying to push it under the rug. They're saying, well, we sort of have to mention it. It just makes sense that these characters would talk about that. You know, and it is the case of rape, so maybe abortion's okay. But they very, very quickly have Deanna say no. It's not going to happen. And then they brush it aside. So it's one of only two times when abortion... Well, this is the only time that I know of when abortion is actually mentioned by name in relationship to, you know, one of our characters, the Federation characters. There was one other episode, Sacred Realm in Enterprise, which was filmed, of course, many, many years later, where abortion was mentioned. But it was only... for an alien, you know, non-Federation, non-human character who were even thinking about abortion. You know, they never have our characters do it. This was really risky for Star Trek. I mean, and Star Trek does not generally go there. And that's one of the main reasons that I'm really fascinated by this episode, that they did it. I mean, they actually used the word and talked about it, albeit briefly. But I was trying to say, even before we get to the gravity of abortion, just sex in general is amazing, because there's only a few instances in Trek where, you have the premarital sex. I mean, I mentioned a few of them, but I think the biggest one, of course, is David Marcus. Obviously, Kirk, when he was younger, had an affair with Carol Marcus, and they produced a baby, and they did not get married. That was a big deal. But it was in a movie. Maybe they're, you know, one of the greatest Star Trek stories of all time, of course. And I think it was great because it went there, because it was allowing itself to talk about these deeper issues, which Star Trek hardly ever talked about.
I mean, by the way, we do have another instance that comes up in TNG in just 2 years' time, right? When Worf and Kadar end up having Alexandra out of wedlock, and right. I mean, Worf himself, I mean, he's the traditionist, or I mean, perhaps even, you know, the conservative on the side. He does then try to go for, you know, to get married to Kadar at that point. But that does come through as well.
Even though he doesn't know that she's pregnant, right? Just because they had sex, he wanted to get married. You mm-hmm. know, so the show is showing the conservative beliefs. And even though they did eventually have this not get married, they did have sex, but they didn't get married. At least it was an alien, right? So it wasn't one of our human characters doing that. I think this whole issue of premarital sex, Star Trek is sometimes confused about what they want to do with it. You know, there's implications in justice and maybe the one about throwing a stone in the DS9 episode with where they go to Ryza. I can't remember the name.
Let he who is without sin.
Right, that one. Right. So a couple episodes where they seem to imply premarital sex is okay, or like Jadzia Dax has premarital sex all the time. That was definitely mentioned. But I don't know. It seems like they're a little timid about that, and they're obviously really timid about gay rights, which is a separate issue for different episodes to talk about that.
Yeah, they briefly touch on that. Okay, well, if we've exhausted this part, it's now time to have a baby.
Well, with abortion in particular, like I said, it's sort of thrown away in this episode. They didn't really want to deal with it, so they sort of threw it away. I don't know if you guys know or read the novels, but there was actually a novel by John Vornholt. It's TNG novel number 16 called Contamination, where the main characters in the novel are Troy and Worf. They have to team up to solve a murder that happened on the Enterprise. And that novel very much deals with the fact that, you know, it's set about a year after this episode, and Troy is dealing with the fact that she doesn't really like Worf that much. They're very different people, and she has this memory of, well, he wanted to kill my baby. You know, it's sort of an interesting step in their relationship, where they go from being these people that work together, don't really like each other, to sort of becoming friends. And then, of course, later on, they in the seventh season, their relationship takes a weird turn. But it's interesting, you know, that these things weren't dealt with on screen, but some novels deal with them.
Okay. Well then, is it time to have a baby? No time like the present. Not,
if we're going chronologically, I got some more stuff to talk about before that.
Go ahead.
So they go and they meet Hester Delt, right? This happens right before the birth. And I find it funny when they call down to Hester Delt, the scientist who's, you know, given them the bacteria to take. And Picard says, "To whom am I speaking?" And Hester Delt responds, "To whom are you speaking?" Huh. Like, what was Hester Delt thinking there? Was he thinking, well, I'm Hester Delt. Don't you know who I am? Huh. Didn't you read your mission brief? Or was he, like, really focusing on the word whom? Like, who are you, Picard, to use the proper term whom instead of who, like everybody else does? I don't, like, what was Hester talking about there?
Maybe he's full of himself, just a little bit.
I find Hester to be an interesting little character in this episode.
Well, I mean, he hailed a man, he says, okay, hello, now, let's get started. Well, who are you? You know, obviously Picard has an alpha personality, and so does he, so they're going to clash a little bit. Okay.
And I have to say, I mean, I quite like the guy. I think that, you know, in terms of having a, you know, he's a perfectly competent scientist on the show that has to do a job. You know, he doesn't turn out to be either incompetent or evil. And usually in the portrayal of scientists in a lot of TV, that's, you know, that's pretty good. That's a successful run for a scientist.
Okay.
Yeah, I liked his character. I also like the whole mission, right? They're taking these viruses and bacteria or whatever. And I like the fact that they did not create an artificial clock, you know? You remember in Angel 1, back in the first season, they were like, we have to get the Enterprise to the neutral zone. Everybody's, you know... And Data, like, calculates to the second exactly when he can leave. But here in this episode, all they say is that the Rakelis system has desperate pleas for help. And there's even acknowledgement later in the episode that this may not work. We may never find a cure. You know, so I like the realism that's put in this. Oh, and Pulaski saying, this is really risky, but it's probably the best thing we could do. You know, there's no artificial drama here with some artificial ticking clock. It's much more realistic, and I like that about the whole virus subplot that's going on in the episode.
Okay. What else you got?
Let's see. Have you noticed that in this episode, Picard uses the word grand, like, sarcastically a couple times?
Yeah, I noticed that. Patrick Stewart is obviously English, and I actually don't think it would be in his vocabulary to use it in a way that he has written to use it. So whenever you hear Patrick Stewart say it, it immediately kind of, like, you know, stuck out. So he has a couple. I think there are only two grands, but I certainly noticed them.
I also noticed when he got in the turbolift to go to 10 Ford, he gets in the turbolift and he says, Deck 1, Ford Station 1. Or he says, Deck 10, Ford Station 1. You know, instead of just saying 10 Ford, which they did the rest of the time. It's this economy of words. I'm like, when you've gone to Deck Ford for the last year that you've been on the ship, have you always said Deck 10, Ford Station 1? Anyway,
never thought that. Okay, can we have the baby now?
By the way, is this before or after Pulaski starts having a go at Data for being the cold hand of technology? Are you picking that up now or in a second?
Yes, I do have that in here.
It happens about now. Yeah, when Data brings in Troy to have the baby.
Yeah. You know, and obviously we need armed guards to have a baby. And apparently we also need a belligerent Dr. Pulaski to demonstrate an amazing amount of disrespect to Data. I mean, Deanna needs the comfort of a human touch, not the cold hand of technology. I gotta say, this is pretty much where she turns me off, right here.
In the next episode. In the next episode, she's worse. And I don't think she ever recovers for the rest of the series.
No, actually, she does. It seems I went ahead to the third episode, and it seems like she is a little nicer to him.
Oh, no, but I mean, in my mind. Yeah. In my mind, she's gone.
she's gone. Yeah, she just... I mean, even later with the data, whatever. It just... I don't know. She just turns you off. But again, how many... Either of you see L.A. Law?
No.
No, I never saw her character in that. I know about it.
Yeah, she played Rosalind Chase, and she's pretty much the same kind of character on L.A. Law. And I've always said that when she left TNG, she should have been knocked down a turbo shaft because that's how she dies in L.A. Law. They're waiting at her and Leland are waiting at the elevator, and you hear ding, doors open, and she says, "And I don't want to talk about it any further." And she steps in, and all of a sudden you hear ah. Boom, boom, boom type of thing. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be fitting if she actually had that happen to her on Star Trek? She steps into her turbo lift and Picard can't get her beamed out in time.
Yep, Yeah.
No, that would have been awful.
No.
Oh, come on, you guys.
We're going to wait for our Spock's mother before we ever do something like that.
What? You have a problem with Spock's...
Spock's mother.
Original mother?
Well, I don't know.
Or the stepmother.
I suppose it's a stepmother.
What are you referring to?
The 2009 movie.
Oh, you mean when she tries to get beamed away and she ends up falling?
Oh, I see. What you're saying.
So that's what I'm saying. She falls and they can't get her out, but they can get somebody else out. It was flying down at whatever.
Yeah, but she didn't deserve it, though.
No. I don't know.
All right, so Pulaski Data. Obviously, I mean, this has been talked about many times. Obviously, the show was trying to recreate some of the dynamic that Bones and Spock had. Mm-hmm. And the reason it doesn't work here is because Spock would push back on Bones. Spock had chosen the life that he was leading. He had chosen to be a Vulcan. And so when Bones harasses him about being logical and being a Vulcan, Spock can push back.
Yeah.
But Data didn't choose to be an android, and in some respects doesn't want to be an android. He wants to grow beyond it. So whenever Pulaski harasses him about it, number one, he's too polite to push back. And number two, he agrees with her in some respects about some aspects of himself. He wants to improve. And so that's why the dynamic doesn't work. But in this episode, I don't feel that it's too bad. I mean, it's the first time that Pulaski's ever met Data, or an android, presumably. And she just doesn't know him. She's a little reluctant, and she's just trying to look out for her patient. Once again, she's the professional, right? Troy comes in, she's going to have a baby, it's a situation because the father is also the baby and there was a rape involved. And, she's just trying to comfort Deanna. You notice how she's asking her if she's in any pain and also doesn't assume that she would want painkillers, right? She's like, hey, it won't diminish the experience. Pulaski is the professional. And she doesn't know Data. So, I don't know. I sort of give her a little more room to grow here. And don't harass her too much for not knowing immediately what Data's like and how much Deanna and other people already think of him as a friend.
It's interesting that the way humans treat technology, for instance, the doctor on Voyager, why are they so rude to him? Obviously, because he's just a piece of technology. And that's kind of what a lot of people do to Data. Well, obviously, because he's just a piece of technology. He has no more feelings than a replicator. Or, I don't know. Was there ever a reference of a toaster?
A walking toaster?
In Measure of a Man. So it comes up in a couple of episodes. He gets referred to as a toaster.
He's a toaster, yeah.
And, one problem that I have with that reference is that I assume that toasters became irrelevant in, 2150. So you've probably got people referencing ancient technology that isn't in use anymore.
Yeah.
But that's another issue. There's a lot of this, placement of modern day technology, and by modern day I mean 1990s or 1960s or whenever, and then pushing that forward into the 23rd century or the 24th century, and then having the guys in that point being absolute experts in our modern day life, which is very unrealistic.
Okay.
But actually, I kind of agree with Data. I think I think that the reason why Pulaski's interaction with Data doesn't work is, I think you're kind of pretty much in the right area there. I don't think in this episode she's horrendously bad. I think in the next episode she is, and I'm going to wait until then to bury her, because I really don't like her at all, and in particular how she reacts to Data. I don't know. I think that, by the way, one thing that I always got the impression with the Doctor coming in Voyager is that now you're not. I don't exactly know when holodecks were supposed to be, you interact with them properly in the real world or in the real Star Trek continuity. But you're led to believe in early TNG that you're not supposed to be able to interact with people that are fully human-like. But then as TNG goes on, you do have more and more human-like holograms appear. As a result, I always got the impression that the Data would have come in as an artificial life form when people wouldn't be used to interacting with fully-fledged human holograms, whereas the Doctor comes in once everyone has got all their holonovels sorted and you have all these well-formed characters. So in a way, the Doctor's coming in as an example of a kind of person that they've interacted with before and have always interacted as, you know, as a synthetic person. So that's why I kind of always see the Doctor's kind of coming in a much more difficult situation, because everyone is experienced with dealing with holograms, and everyone's experienced in dealing with holograms and effectively not treating them like humans, whereas Data isn't, wasn't like that. But I digress.
It's all right. No problem.
I like this... I like the little moment, like, early on in the pregnancy, or the birth, right, in sick bay, where Data and Troy are talking about what it's like to be pregnant. You know, Data's really interested in how much she knows about the baby, and there's even this philosophical discussion that it really starts to verge on discussion about, you know, when is the spark of life? When did Ian become a life form? He's still in vitro, and is Deanna able to sense her? Especially because she's telepathic, right? Or at least a little bit. With certain people, and you would think the baby, who's half Betazoid like she is, she might have this telepathic link. So there's this whole discussion, again, that's verging on that territory of abortion rights, right? You know, is the baby its own unique entity, or is it just, you know, a mass of flesh that the mother can abort wants to? Huh. So again, there's that little bit of hint at that kind of stuff, but the show didn't go there in great detail. Because then suddenly Deanna's like, nope, I'm having a baby. And Data does that moment where he acts like the typical nervous father.
Yeah, doctor, doctor, doctor. Yeah, gotcha. What do you think of the futuristic birthing chair? Well, I guess since I've never had a baby either lying down or in the birthing chair, it doesn't matter to us. But actually, I can't help but think that would seem more comfortable to be in that chair than laying down in a bed.
By the way, can I ask a question? Has anyone been at a birth?
What's that?
Has anyone been at a birth? Everyone.
I was
has
at
experienced...
the birth of both of my
oh,
kids.
Oh yeah.
Because I don't think chairs work. I don't think chairs work at all.
It's
natural
gravity.
No, I don't. The gravity is not your friend as you're giving birth.
I think it certainly can be. Yeah. And many different women choose many different ways to give birth. I mean, a lot of it's sort of maybe a little bit new age still.
Oh, yeah.
But my wife and I, we went through that whole process, you know, when she was pregnant, trying to decide, you know, you can do the in-water birth now.
Yeah.
That a lot of people like. In most hospitals, in the maternity ward, the beds come with bars over the top of the bed, or at least they're convertible, right?
Yeah.
So, because some women choose to squat and hold on to that bar for support. And gravity does help.
Yeah, no, if I remember correctly, they're scooted way down to the end of the bed anyway, so it's, you know, the bottom half really is at a downward angle. But I'm just thinking, laying in the bed, you know, everything, it could be upright in that chair, which will help with gravity. And the doctors, you know, like Bill Cosby says, like the Johnny Bench sitting there waiting for the thing to come out, and they know how to support the head and the body and everything. So I don't know. I think gravity is your friend in this case.
I mean, what I really mean to say is that, you know, it's not the case of just standing up or sitting upright and the baby kind of like falls out. Right. So it's not that. There's a complicated procedure in which, you know, the head needs to be engaged and then has to be pushed through.
Right.
And it's a relatively tricky bit of gymnastics the baby goes through, you know, with or without gravity kind of like pointing you out in the right direction. What you always find, though, and by the way, in this particular show, you can give it a pass because it's an Adian baby, and Adian babies can do whatever they like. Mm. But I don't think there are very many instances of births on television that are either the length or in terms of the in terms of kind of the noise or the mess that real life births.
Of course not. There's at some point, I don't want to get too disgusting, but at some point there's a massive surge of plasma, I'll call it, that accompanies baby that obviously would have been all over Dr. Pulaski in that case. So no, there's a lot of things missing. The fact the baby can focus on you is another thing. No, that doesn't happen in a real birth. But one thing I am curious about, I know this is a digression, but since we're talking about birth and we'll never do it again in this series, what do you think was the problem on Voyager with when Naomi was actually transported out of Samantha? Why do you think that caused some sort of imbalance?
I think the only way they explained that away was the fact that she was an alien. I mean, there's no reason that a human baby transported out would have a problem.
It shouldn't be. You know? I wouldn't think so, because if you think about it, that would mean every time Samantha was transported off the ship by transporter, that it would have affected the fetus all that time. So I don't understand the difference of just beaming her out.
I think the only thing that is a little bit questionable is you assume that if you're transporting out the baby, that the umbilical cord will have to be disconnected, right? You're going to transport out the baby, but leave the umbilical cord.
Which would
go ahead. And typically, when a baby's born, the umbilical cord stays connected until the baby has had his first breath. And then, then the placenta will pass naturally if you just let it go on. But typically, in most modern hospitals, they cut the umbilical cord at that point.
Right.
That would be a bit of a shock even for a human baby to suddenly not have the umbilical cord before they've taken their first breath, through their lungs. So, yeah, that could be a problem. But, again, the whole chemical imbalance thing, I think that was just a writer's excuse, to say, oh, we can do anything because they're an alien baby.
So. The Katarian part. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so we discussed the birthing chair. Let's see.
This is a very interesting acting situation for Marina Sirtis, right? I mean, obviously, acting out a birth is difficult enough for an actress to do. It's got to be embarrassing, but I guess actresses get into embarrassing situations. But this one's even more weird because she's in no pain, right? Right. So she's supposed to be acting like, I'm giving birth, but there's no pain. I'm just feeling the greatness and sensations of birth and the pressure. And she's also a little bit telepathic. You think she'd have this little bit telepathic connection with the baby and might be experiencing the birth from the baby's point of view. And I think Marina does a great job. I mean, you just watch her face during the birth. It's all kinds of complex emotions that are going on there, and mostly positive. Mostly a very interesting, positive experience. Like, she's experiencing the baby's birth into the world through her telepathic link. It's really quite interesting. And it may explain why, apparently, her telepathic link with Riker was off. Because she didn't know he was standing there. You'd think she would have noticed that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
You would have. Did you guys find that a little creepy that Riker came in to watch the birth? I don't know.
No.
Really? No, I think it's a little bit weird that he kind of, he's sitting there and doesn't introduce himself. But by the way, I mean, I'm going to echo something that Data mentioned. Throughout the first season, I think I've been relatively positive on Marina Sirtis and, and the Troi character in general. I mean, yes, there are instances where it's, there's a bit of a duff either scene or lines or whatever, but I think that's true of everyone. And I mean, my favorite character is Data, and I think it's very true of Data. I think Data comes into the first season pretty badly written sometimes. But this episode, I think Marina Sirtis is good in this episode, and I actually think that the Troi character is good. And I'm not quite sure where I'm expected to actually completely hate the Troi character and think that she's the worst thing on the show, because I thought that Marina Sirtis did very well. And I think that she's mentioned that, I mean, by this point, I think she does have kids now, but by this point she hadn't had kids. And I think that, her performance was absolutely fine, given that you know, given what she was asked to do, I really have no complaints.
No, I don't see any problems with the way she did it either.
I always thought the main complaint with Troy as a character, as a main character, was that, you know, they so rarely let her do the counseling thing, you know. In this episode, Guinan is the one counseling Wesley. And when they let her do good stuff, she does great. It's just that there's so many episodes where it seems like she's not doing anything. And that's what people are frustrated about with the Troy character.
Okay. Well, anyway, after she gives birth, Worf gives the baby a small grunt. And then Data thanks Deanna for allowing him to participate.
I think Worf's grunt was because, you know, the baby's there. Pulaski declares it just a baby. That's what she says. Just a baby. And Worf's like, oh. He's like he's disappointed. Oh, I wish it was something else that I could fight.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Ian Andra after her father. Then, of course, she sees Will. Now, what'd you think of Will's interaction with Deanna after giving birth? I liked it, actually. I thought it was really, really neat. Comments? You know, he's beautiful, Deanna, just like his mother type thing. Anything?
I liked it. I mean, again, their relationship wasn't dealt with a lot in later seasons, but these early seasons, you know, you have these little hints and like I said, I was teasing a little bit about it being a little creepy that he was there, but it made sense. He cares about her, and she's going through this situation. He wants to support her. It was actually sort of weird that Data got to be the father during the birth instead of Will, you know, but he was the one who happened to be in the corridor at the time. But
right. Okay.
But it was a nice touching moment, as you say.
I mean, maybe I think I'm completely out on the limb here because I don't like Riker during this early time, and in particular, I don't like his. It's not that I don't like the Riker Troy relationship. I think that's fine, and they can have a relationship, but I don't like the way he treats her. And right at the beginning of the episode, when you know they choose to announce that you know Deanna is pregnant by you know bringing her into the conference room and announcing it. Now, initially, it's just announced that she's pregnant, not that she's pregnant by being raped by an alien life bulb. So at that point, it's just, oh, she's pregnant. And then no one says, oh, well, congratulations, or anything like that. And Riker kind of pretty quickly moves on to, well, I don't mean to be insensitive, but who's the dad? And I didn't like the way that I don't actually think that Riker treats Troy particularly well. So when kind of like Riker then kind of like manages to sneak into the berth and to hang around, I would have thrown him out.
Yeah, it was a little interesting in the briefing room, like you mentioned. Like maybe it's sort of a 1950s version of what a guy might do to protect a ex-girlfriend who's pregnant. And you notice in the briefing room how Picard says, "Counselor Troy is pregnant." And Riker says nothing. And then Picard says, she's going to have a baby. And then Riker says, a baby? It's like he didn't know the meaning of the word pregnant. He waited until she's going to have a baby to react. It was like, what is up with that?
This is a surprise. More so for me. Yeah. Okay. So Pulaski finally reports to the bridge and tells Picard Deanna's body looks as if the incident had never occurred. And so they decide to pay a visit to Deanna and her baby. My goodness. What do you think of the instant growth rate? And not only that, you may not have very much about the instant growth rate, but did you notice Pulaski cringe when he talked?
She was kind of, well, I took it that she was surprised.
Yeah, she...
I think that she was expecting, you know, let's just assume it's very, very fast physical changes. But I think that she was surprised that, you know, the cognitive side was there as well. That's what I took it as.
And it's more than that. I mean, obviously there's some kind of alien magic going on because we've already talked about your you're breaking the rules of conservation of mass for the kid to grow that quickly. So there's obviously something going on to allow for the physical, which would include the brain development, the cognitive development, but to learn the vocabulary, even if you had a fully developed brain. You know, like, for instance, in the original series, The Changeling, when Uhura had her memory wiped, you know, you have a fully developed adult brain, and then it takes a while to relearn the language.
Yeah.
I mean, it took the entire weekend for Uhura, didn't it?
I know, totally. And she seemed to know Swahili, even though nobody was teaching her. Okay, bad example.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. We could go on about that.
So, it's just more alien shenanigans, right? I mean, obviously, this alien, maybe the alien's pulling this information out of Deanna's brain and replicating it in the kid's brain, you know, in order to allow it to develop much faster than it was possible. And that I can see how that would really insult, I don't know if insult's the right word, but really surprise Pulaski. I mean, like I've said, Pulaski is a great doctor. She's a professional. And this whole situation just flies in the face of any scientific reality, you know? She's like, well, I don't even know how much I can do to help. I mean, Deanna, I can't even help Deanna recover from her pregnancy and birth because I can no longer, she ever had birth, you know? I mean, even that's been taken care of. And Pulaski is now not doing much in that whole plot. And now she's just in the disease plot, you know, transporting the disease, which we'll get to a little bit more.
Okay. Well, anyway, you know, I say potato, you might say potato. I say tomato, you might say tomato. Everybody says data, but what does Pulaski do?
Data, look at this.
Data.
What?
My name. It is pronounced data.
Oh?
You called me data.
What's the difference?
One is my name. The other is not.
Is this possible? With all your neural nets, algorithms, and heuristics? Is there some combination that makes up a circuit for bruised feelings? Possible?
Commander Data, if you have completed your review, you're needed in Transporter Room 3.
Aye, sir. Excuse me, Doctor.
That's all right, Data. One minute.
I think the interesting thing about this, right, is that I've seen an interview with Patrick Stewart where he says that he wasn't given direction as to whether or not to pronounce it as data, which would be, I mean, I assume most Americans would pronounce the actual word, you know, data as data. Or to pronounce it, you know, in the way that he ended up doing it. And it was, I believe he at least inferred that it was left to him as a choice. So had he chosen the other way around, I suppose we could have had, you know, Data as being the character, which to me doesn't sound right.
No, it wouldn't.
After 25 years of having watched the show.
It's because we have this experience with this character. And believe me, I can tell you from personal experience, there are many times I introduce myself or I meet somebody who's only seen my name in writing and they'll call me Data. You know? So, with people who don't have a connection to Star Trek, they don't know how to pronounce it. It's not that big a deal. And that's why, again, I don't think it's that big a deal that Pulaski mispronounces it here. She obviously is used to saying it a certain way. And I find it interesting how she does react. You know, when Data shows bruised feelings, she seems genuinely interested. You know, I mean, she's taken out a tricorder.
You think that's genuine?
No, I think she's being condescending.
That's exactly. I don't see genuine.
See, it's totally how you read the scene, but I think it is as condescending. I don't think she's being condescending. I think she's being fascinated. She's being interested. And look at Data's expression. Of course, Data often has expressions that he really shouldn't because supposedly he doesn't have emotions. But Data is also, for an instant, interested. You know? She says, Pulaski says, wow, do you have bruised feelings? Is that possible? And Data is actually interested in the possibility. I think if this relationship had continued, that these two characters would have found a real connection. Anyway, so
I just got sarcasm.
I just see it differently. Wow. I don't think it's that bad. I think people feel much more hurt because they're so used to Data, they like Data, and they just immediately jump to, she's a bitch. You know, Pulaski,
Yeah. No, I do feel that I do read it as she's being, you know, she's being condescending, and then to make matters worse, I send Data as being innocent and then not picking up on that fact. And I think that's why he then kind of, you know, he becomes interested. And that's really what I think that's really the heart of why I don't like the Pulaski character, and in particular the relationship between her and Data, is because I think that she's, for want of a better word, she's evil, and he's too innocent to know that she's evil. Evil is the wrong word, but that's how I always read it.
Okay. Well, anyway. So let's change the topic a little bit. The puppies. What do you think of the puppies?
Where did these puppies come from?
Don't know.
They didn't. They must have been born on the ship because they weren't. They didn't look particularly old.
No, they just had a litter. Where's the mother?
You know, it's funny. They call this place the nursery.
Yeah.
It seemed like a daycare to me. I don't know why they were using the nursery.
The doggy daycare.
There's like, oh, is it the doggy nursery? Maybe. I don't know. It's just,
must be.
But I don't know what this room was. It didn't look like a normal daycare to me for you know, kids that would have been about six. There wasn't the typical trappings. You know, it was obviously a redress set. But they did have the alphabet up on the wall. Two alphabets. I don't know what the second one was.
Well, maybe there's a special area for puppies, and it's all part of the same nursery. Fascinating. Okay, so let's go on to the other important topic, and that's the samples that we're transporting. Let's go back. Picard never played with puppies. What? Are you serious? Picard has never played with puppies? What kind of life is that?
He grew up on a farm, but not a... or I forget. Which one's which? The one where you grow things is a farm, and the one where you have animals, that's also a farm, I guess. But different type of farm. Apparently, there were no animals when he was growing up. We know he was really studious. I don't know. It tells you a little bit about his character, I guess.
I mean, I think it's in keeping with his character. I don't think he comes across as a guy that ever played with puppies.
Yeah. Really?
He was too busy inside building his models of Permelian battleships.
Yeah,
there you go.
Did anybody else notice that Miss Gladstone, the woman who runs the nursery, apparently, the actress is Dawn Arneman, as we mentioned earlier in the episode, she looks a lot like Nana Visitor, like a young version of Kira Nerys. I thought so.
Fascinating.
Very similar features.
Okay. So the plasma stuff is starting to, or the medical samples are starting to grow, and nobody can figure out why. But we got to figure it out. But before we do, let's run to 10 forward and see how Wesley's handling life, and thinking of what he has to do now. How do you guys like the? I think we talked about the interaction with him and Guinan. What do you guys think of?
I mean, I would say that I generally like the Guinan character, and I think that she gets better stuff to work with, certainly in later episodes. When she's talking to Wesley, I generally just, maybe it's just that I'm not that engaged in that conversation, but I didn't think that she really brought a huge amount to change Wesley's mind or to guide him or anything. So I kind of thought it was a little flat. But I do like Wesley. In general, and I do like Guinan, and I think that it's a, you know, it's 10 forwards being used in a way that I suggested that it, you know, it's going to be used as a way of developing things and having people to speak. But I wasn't, you know, that impressed by the chat, although, you know, the full on head on warp effect was pretty nice.
Yeah, it was awesome. I think what I think the moral of the story there was is, you know, she keeps asking him if he wants this or he wants that. You know, I'm just doing what's expected of me. You know, don't you always do what's expected of you, or are you going to step outside your box someday? So,
I think the thing about Guinan is, I mean, in this conversation, for instance, she's saying, do you always do what's expected of you? But they always write her in such a way that she gets to be, like, mystical about it, right? Mm-hmm. Where she comes over and she asks him if he wants a drink three times. And then she gets to her point. She always has these roundabout ways of getting to a point. And it's almost like I wasn't sure Wesley, this, you know, 16-year-old Wesley, would even get the subtext. But he does. I mean, pretty clearly. That's the thing about Guinan. Instead of just being direct, she seems more mystical because she adds on these, I don't know, extra words, or, you know, when she could have just gotten to the point.
Probably more like changes the dynamic of the story based on the person listening. So, okay, well, anyway. So he's been summoned back to the bridge, and we have, growth. Module L-73 is experiencing growth. And as Ming Ming Duckling would say, this is serious. Now wait, Data, you have children. Do you know who Ming Ming Duckling is?
Oh yeah, I do. Yeah. We've got a whole set here in the house that my daughter just loves.
You have the whole Wonder Pet set?
Yeah, we got all three of them.
Okay.
Lenny and Tuck and Ming Ming too.
There we go. Nice.
All three of them.
Nice. And James is now going, what the hell? Okay.
That has not made its way over to the UK.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, that's very possible.
Okay. Yes, and look it up. It's Wonder Pets. Okay.
What's going to work? Teamwork.
Yeah, it's all about teamwork. You know, these little classroom animals, they sit in their cages until the kids are gone, and all of a sudden they're... Their phone rings because there's an animal in distress, and they have to work together to help save the animal. So
the phone is ringing. The phone will be right there. The phone is ringing. There's an animal in trouble. Somewhere.
It's kids love it, so if you can find it online, check it out and see what your little ones think of it. It's really cute.
So, with the radiation, right?
Yeah.
Of course, yet again, mystical Aichner radiation, instead of using something that actually exists. So, I flashback a little earlier, Pulaski is... You know, in that scene with Data, she was given a recommendation to the captain about should we bring these things aboard or not. And she's like, you know, if any one of them get loose, we're all going to be dead in a matter of hours. But I have got no better idea. Really? No better idea? You know, about like putting the whole containment area into a shuttlecraft or sending it in a totally separate environment instead of intermixing it? Or how about, how about putting only a skeleton crew on the star drive section and just using the star drive section for this mission? I mean, it seems like so many obvious ways they could have reduced the risk here. Although they do mention star drive separation eventually when a problem shows up. But I don't know. It seemed like there were some obvious ways around this. And then when the specimen starts growing, right, Hester Delt says he cannot destroy it. I'm like, it's a virus. It's just a small little tiny thing. I mean, you can't destroy it? What kind of super Kryptonian virus is this?
Well, plus another thing, they say, why don't we just jettison the thing? He said, we can't do that. It will go into a spora until it, whatever a spora is, until it comes into contact with a planet or another ship. And I was thinking, well, why don't they just do that? Jettison the thing, let it float, and they could put a tractor beam on it and drag it with them. It can't affect anybody. What's it going to do, explode or something? So if it goes into that spora, that's fine. Let it until we can figure out a way to deal with it.
it's still made up of atoms, yeah, right? I mean, just dump some antimatter on it. It's going to disappear from this universe. I mean, it's obviously a little ridiculous that they say that they can't do anything about
it. Well, it all goes back to Apollo 13, you know, if Swigert can't dock this thing, we don't have a mission. Well, that's not exactly true. If he couldn't do it, they'd just back up and do it again. And if he couldn't do it again, then somebody else will do it again. But, so, yeah, whatever. Okay.
Well, that in that case, you might run out of fuel. I mean,
yeah, perhaps.
Apollo 13 has a little more limits to it than the Enterprise Definitely. D. I mean, we have to admit that.
Definitely, yeah.
Did you notice, like, there was a brief scene there where Pulaski was reading about the virus off the screen,
yeah,
and the what she's saying is ahead of the graphics that they put into the episode. Wow. So she said stuff about Eigner radiation that hasn't appeared on screen yet, and then the screen flashes to that. And it's just,
well, it seems
little,
like she, when she was reading it, her body was blocking the screen, if I remember correctly. And then
no, there's a shot of her shoulder where you can clearly read,
yeah,
that information. It just doesn't show up until after she had already said it. Wow. So it's just this, like,
she's smart. You know, what are you going to do? She's very smart. Okay, so anyway, let's see. And it turns out to be Ian who's causing the problem with the Acne radiation and may cause a destruction of the ship, so he decides to leave the ship. How? Well, not by a shuttle or transporter. He decides to die in his human form and return to his ball of light. What do you guys think about the idea of the way Ian decided to die? Do you think that was pretty gutsy for Star Trek?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a really chilly moment when he just matter-of-factly states that he's going to leave, you know, and you understand that he means die. I mean, having a kid die on screen, it's pretty gutsy for a television show, yeah.
That's pretty cool. Well,
they've definitely built up this relationship between, in a very short time, Deanna and Ian, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, she's putting him to bed, she's like rubbing his hair, and then she's lowering the shade on the window. Although why you need to do that, I don't know, you're out in space. Just in case you fly by a star, I guess. You don't want it to be too bright.
Well, there's still stars in the window. You can see a little white coming in.
And you noticed there was an earlier scene when they were sitting down for lunch, and Picard and Pulaski visited.
Yeah.
And for a moment, when the door chime happened, you can see that Deanna was pissed that somebody was bothering her.
No, and she probably knew who it was, too. And she could sense what they were not what they were thinking, but the tension that was on the other side of the door. Yeah, she was a little annoyed by that. Okay. So anyway, what do you think of Deanna's acting here, you know, during the death scene? You must save him! And so on. Did she do pretty good there?
I think Marina Sirtis is good throughout the episode. I'm not going to be a Deanna hater this week.
Okay. All right, so then, anyway, you know, he turns into his ball light and telepathically tells Deanna the reason for his visit. And she understands and tells him that we will miss him, and, you know, I guess we will. So, Ian's gone, the medicine samples are gone, Wesley's gone. Oh, wait, not so fast, Captain Lou. Wesley says he wants to remain on the Enterprise. It all depends what Mommy says. So as long as she agrees and Data is assigned to oversee his schooling, Worf will tuck him into bed so he can, you know, he could stay then. And Riker gets to, what is it that Riker gets to do besides show him how to be a man?
I thought that was it.
I think that was the implication. The things that go beyond school and getting a good night's sleep. I think the implication is you're going to teach him how to have good girlfriends or something.
Yes. Hey, Ashley. I mean, we have Ashley coming. Ashley Judd coming in later on, and man, he aimed high. Okay, he aimed pretty high there. Okay.
Well, he had to get through the dolphin first.
So. Oh, that's true. Yeah, she wasn't all that bad, but yeah, little quirky teenage one there.
You do notice that. I mean, Deanna's son dies,
yeah,
and she's like, "I'll miss him." And then what appears to be mere minutes later, she's up on the bridge and joining in the ribbing of Wesley.
Yes. Right. Is it no family medical leave in the future? I mean, shouldn't she have a little... I mean, they should have had a counselor for the counselor.
I mean, I think the only thing that I would say in its defense is that, I mean, although the baby, or although, you know, Ian, who has been with her for at least, what, 5 days or something like that, does disappear, it's not as if he does die. And it's just, you know, this is more of a kind of experience that you shared with an alien life form rather than actually having a son or a daughter die on her.
Well, yeah.
So I think it's slightly different, although, you know, obviously, given the episodic nature of TV at this time, they weren't prepared to have 18 months worth of grieving of one of the main characters after having lost a child. I don't think that was ever on the table.
Yeah.
By the way, something we haven't spoken about at all. Obviously, this is are you guys aware that this is a Star Trek Phase 2 script that was recycled?
No, I was Luke? Not.
So this is a script that was put together for the kind of relaunch of the original series in the 70s that kind of, you know, hung around. And the interesting thing in my mind about Phase 2 is that you can see that it got translated into the motion picture. And then, in my opinion at least, you can see that key things then got translated into Next Generation. And in particular, you know, Riker... and the Troy relationship really comes from the idea Decker relationship of the motion picture. And what this was supposed to be a story where Idea got pregnant, and, you know, pretty much the same story, but you can see that there is this kind of these connections between, you know, there would have been between Idea and Deckard, and the I can't remember what the Vulcan character would have been. But you have those, and you do have instances where apparently they were able to bring the script over pretty much without a huge number of changes. So I do think that it's interesting from that perspective, that this kind of exists.
I think if you're interested in the original script was like last year, or maybe even more recently than that, you know, the fan production Star Trek Phase 2 or Star Trek New Voyages, they took that original script and made it.
Oh.
It was slightly rewritten in order to use Kirk instead of Decker, that kind of stuff, because their production has the original series crew. But they used a Delton woman in that story. And it's interesting how all the disease subplot that's in this episode about how they're transporting disease, that wasn't in the original. That was added to create a little bit of drama, although it wasn't too false, in my opinion, as I've stated. But the story was much more about this alien coming aboard. And it was much more clear in that episode that it was that the alien was born to the Elton woman. That their race of energy beings or life force entities or whatever, two of them entered her body, created an offspring who has to be born as a baby, grow up for a while, and then die in order to join the rest of his race. It's a slightly different take on the story. It's sort of interesting.
Okay. All right. Well, then, have we left off anything before we go into our final thoughts and ratings?
No, I'm good to go.
Mr. Data? That makes it better.
I'm ready.
Okay, then.
Okay, it's now time to give a rating to this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is the worst and 5 is the best. Now, actually, can I defer? I'm going to defer onto you first, Lou, because at the top of the show, Data came in and he said that he really liked it. You came in and said that you didn't like it very much. And I believe that I'm in the middle, and I'd like to land in the middle, because we've sometimes had a bit of a surprise that what I mean by like and you mean by hate, we kind of end up with the same score.
Right.
So I'm going to defer to you first, Lou.
Okay. Well, this episode gets a lot of poo-poo tossed at it, and sometimes it's for good reason. The medicine sample transport to build up some mystery and drama, but it falls short. We don't really get to see what it looks like on the inside. The Ian story comes off as a little strange on how Deanna gets pregnant, but there are some tender moments with Ian. I actually liked Ian. Have you ever played with puppies? Or, you know, why are you here? Because mommy said it was time for dinner. So, you know, I kind of liked the idea of Ian. You know, but when he dies, of course, being a parent, and we're all three parents, we know what it would be like. We have an idea what it would be like. It'd be completely devastating. So for her to be back on the bridge the next hour or 2 hours, or we don't know, it could be 2 days later when the transport was complete, for all we know. Just still seems a little bit quick. Wesley makes a new friend in Guinan, who, I gotta say, I haven't said enough about Guinan yet, but I do love Guinan. I think I'm really gonna appreciate her in the series. Pulaski. She came off crankier, I think crankier and just meaner than Bones ever was. And she just seems to suffer from year-round PMS, in my thoughts. I think she would have been a very interesting character had she gone a different path besides trying to redo Bones and Spock. But she instantly takes jabs at Data, who people really, really love, so I just kind of found it off-putting. Overall, I think it's a very rough start to Season 2, which does have at least 2 5-star episodes for me. And people have started to guess at those, and I still won't reveal them until we get there. But unfortunately, this obviously is just not one of them. I was thinking about giving this a 2, had it not been for the sadder moments with Ian, but it only really gives me enough to give it about an extra 0.5 star. So in the end, I'll stop at 2.5 stars, 2.5. Should we go for the good or the bad next? Oh, you wanted to go at the end. So, Data, what about you? Why don't you tell us where you're at?
Well, like I said, I really like this episode. I think it's a great start for the second season. You can definitely see the new direction the show's going. Much improvements in the just technical performance of the show, as well as the characters are much more solidly there. You have great dynamics, addition of you know, great positive things that have been added to the show, like Guinan. And the story itself is compelling. It's in those one of the classic Trek stories where, even though we may not go quite as far as I would like Trek to go, they do bring up a lot of really serious discussion points, and they don't hit you over the head with the answer that, you know, abortion is okay or isn't okay. It just presents the information for the audience to be exposed to this information. You know, 1988 television show, you know, a family television show. You're going to be exposed to these ideas and then talk about it over the dinner table or something. I mean, that is what Trek is to me. And this is a very good episode for that. Although it does fall down through some of the stuff that's happening. And, you know, the whole disease subplot that was added to the original script that wasn't great, although it does have its own moments with Hester Dell and the professionalism of Dr. Pulaski. So, overall, I think this is a 4-star episode for me.
Okay. 4 stars it be. Okay.
Okay, I suppose I'm next. By the way, I came in watching this one. I think season 2 is one of my is my least favorite seasons of TNG.
Really?
I didn't quite know why. I never quite got attached to some of the stories. But let me just put across the positives that there are in this episode. And I do think that I mean, when we did Encounter at Farpoint, I was very generous, and I did say, look, they get a lot of things right in their setup. So the things that they did correct in terms of the characters and where they placed them and things like that, the design and so on. I think this episode in particular, we do have tweaks, and we'd have tweaks in main cast about where they're located. You know, I think Geordi and going into engineering is very, very good. The additional of 10 Ford is going to be very good going forward. I like the I like that, you know, the tweaks that they make to the show, I think they're all in a positive direction. With the exception, in my opinion, that Pulaski coming on, I really can't stand her that much. So I think that's all good. I think also you can tell that technically I think we are moving in the right direction. I think in terms of the show, I think it's got a very good... I think it's got a competent A and a competent B plot that kind of means that neither of those plots kind of feel, you know, too thin. I think all too often on the first season, we found that the you know, you only had one idea and it was stretched over 45 minutes and there wasn't a huge amount there and you ended up people having to slow down the pace of the show in order to get to the runtime. And I think that that's something that does go away in season two. I think from season two onwards, they're able to put character moments around it, or they're able to put subplots around it in order to do it better. Anyway, this episode, I think Marina Sirtis, as I mentioned, has been good. I do like her, and I think the Troy character in this episode is absolutely fine. I haven't quite stumbled across where the hatred comes from yet, and I thought that she was also good in season one. I quite like the story. I do accept that there are things that you kind of gloss over in terms of either the rape or abortion or any of that. But I do like the idea that, you know, as a way of an alien race discovering about other races, that they end up, you know, they live as one of them and they're born and they're raised and eventually that they die as one of them. So I enjoyed that. I thought that the subplot was interesting as well. I thought that there was nothing too objectionable there. And I liked, you know, the mad scientist dude was perfectly fine. I didn't have very strong memories of this being a particularly good episode, but I think it comes in, you know, pretty, you know, as a very solid average episode of TNG. So I am going to be giving this one a 3-star.
Okay. Can I bring up something that I just thought of and I think maybe we actually should go into? You guys, I have not done this, but both of you have used the word rape. And do you really consider what happened rape? Because for it to be rape, I think there would have to be an intent. And I don't think Ian or the light ball had an intent to violate her. I think he wanted to find out what human life was like, and the only best way he could think of doing it was to go through the process. And so she had to be impregnated. I don't necessarily believe it was like a gangster motorcycle guy, you know, Hell's Angel busted into her quarters and raped her one night and then took off riding into the sunset. So, I mean, I think the word rape is kind of a little harsh in this case.
It's hard because of we don't have the right words, right? I mean, rape implies forcing sexual intercourse or forcing a sexual act. Well, what we're doing here is we're producing an offspring. We're getting her pregnant. And we don't actually have sex. I mean, there was the visual implies that the light bulb might have went up into her,
yeah,
you know, birthing canal, which is physically maybe sex, but it's also a light bulb. It's a piece of energy. It's not a physical act. So she maybe not wasn't physically penetrated. So
right.
I mean, what do you call it when some like say, And I think it happens in Voyager, right? Let's say somebody takes a needle in her arm and suddenly Deanna's pregnant with this baby. I mean, is that rape?
Right.
No, it's not rape as we define it currently, but it's certainly a violation that leads to pregnancy. And in our society, our vernacular, the only word we have for that is rape. You know,
in our current society, correct.
Right.
Right. 24th century, who knows? What if it had been beamed into her body? Could that still be considered? I mean, we don't know how, like you say, we don't know how it entered. I was trying to be a smartass earlier when I said, you know, we see this ball slinking up her leg and all of a sudden it gets to a point where it disappears. But we don't know how it could have entered her. Through her stomach, through her arm, we don't know for sure. I'm just saying the word rape just really doesn't sound right. And since we can't come up with one, maybe the audience can. I mean, does anybody have anything that you would call this if we don't call it a rape? To me, this is a science experiment.
It's a forced pregnancy. I mean, she did not choose to participate in this pregnancy. And being pregnant, I mean, it's much easier on Deanna's body in this episode because of alien magic or whatever. But in reality, of course, being pregnant is a huge encumbrance upon your person.
I imagine.
And to do that without permission, in a ways, that is worse than the physical act of rape. To, you know, make somebody pregnant without permission, that is a deeper violation in some respects.
Okay.
So, yeah, and we don't have a word for it other than forced pregnancy, I guess.
But. Right. Okay, well, I just thought I'd bring that out. Just something about it was bothering me as we went along, and I thought, you know, to end this without airing that probably might be wrong. So, okay, well then, I guess that brings us to the end of episode one. And Data, I have you coming on again.
Measure of a Man.
Measure of a Man on November 8th.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Shields up. Go to red alert.
Fire torpedoes.
Surprise attack hurls the Enterprise into a mysterious void.
The sensors show nothing out there.
But a sinister alien traps the crew in a deadly experiment.
We will fight you.
It's a desperate battle for survival.
Initiate auto-destruct sequence.
On the next exciting episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
So join us again next week when we review episode 2 of season 2, and that's where silence has lease. So thank you very much, Data, for joining us. And I've been James from London.
I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm Data from Washington.
Washington. The state, not D.C.
Yes, the only state that is blank state instead of just saying the word.
Oh, yeah, right. There you go. And it's a good thing, James, that you didn't lose Scotland. Yeah, it was close. 55% was a vote that said that they wanted to remain your countrymen. Aren't you glad?
Yes. But there's a bag of worms to open up as we're signing up.
Yes, definitely. I think I'll wait till Paul is on. And let's see. You know, actually, Paul, I don't have you on for anything this season. So the next one available is the Outrageous Akana, Mr. Finch. You might want to drag that up so we could do this whole Scotland thing. It'd be fun. Plus, my daughter wants to talk to you still. Okay. Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thanks for listening.